There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. I'm so glad that you could join me this week as we once again go diving deep into the collection of cardboard boxes and plastic pages and top holders, and in some cases just shoe boxes or those priority mail boxes. You're just ready to ship some stuff out of the house, aren't you? You've spent plenty of time in quarantine cleaning up those cards, and you are here for some more classic cardboard conversation. And perhaps while you were cleaning up those cards, you're organizing your collection over the last few weeks or months, you probably came across a box or two, or maybe not even a box, could be a stack. That's how I work, just stacks. Organized stackology is what I call it. You don't know where anything is, but as long as I know which stack the thing is that I'm looking for is in, then everything's good in my world. But if it's a stack, or if it's a box, or even if it's a binder, you probably have the miscellaneous box. And I've got a miscellaneous box. Actually, I've got a couple now. Now that I've shuffled some cards around from one box to the other. And the miscellaneous box is truly miscellaneous. There's just some cards or card-like collectibles that I just don't really know where to put or what to do with. I won't give them up for whatever reason, but often in the miscellaneous box, you've got the collectibooks from the 1980s. Remember those? Similar to collectibooks, True Value Hardware put out some big, thick cardboard, not even cards, but just kind of like fold-out player cards for top players. And I've picked up a few of those just in the little nickel boxes at card shows everywhere. And what else you got? You know, like glossy All-Stars, the All-Star cards that Topps used to put in, you know, the glossy subset that they would put in their rack packs in the 1980s. And you've got that box of just cards. That's it. You know, they don't fit nice and neat into a Topps or a Fleer or a Donruss. You can't just put one year on the box. It's just everything ends up in this box. And there is a chance that the three cards that we are going to be talking about today, or the three sets that we're going to be talking about today, chances are you have or have had some of these cards in the miscellaneous box at some point in time. Now, that's not to say that they're bad cards, and I have called them offbeat, and that's not really fair. You know, the more I was looking at these particular cards and the more I was doing some research on them, because I faintly remember some of these cards that we're going to talk about. But, you know, I just wasn't a big collector of them when they came out around 30 years ago. But now I've got a better understanding what they were trying to do, a better appreciation for why those particular cards were made. And, yeah, they may end up in a miscellaneous box, but they shouldn't be considered the cardboard riffraff, which we saw a lot of during the junk wax days in the early 1990s. The three sets that we're talking about, the Topps Big Set, which, as I've really looked at these cards and done some research, I think there's a lot of baseball card history and kudos that have not been given to the Topps Chewing Gum Company for what they tried to do with Topps Big. This actually kind of re-altered a certain portion of baseball card history for me looking at these. So we're going to talk Topps Big, in particular 1988, which is, in my opinion, and I know the opinion of a lot of collectors, the best of the three sets that Topps put out in big format. Then we've got the Conlon collection, which was put together as part of a Sporting News set. You know, everybody was getting in on the baseball card craze in the early 1990s, and the Sporting News was no different, as they basically sponsored, or co-sponsored, I guess would be the right word, a set of cards featuring the classic photographs from the Conlon collection of some of baseball's greatest players. And if not greatest players, greatest names. And we've got one of those great names, one of our random pulls from our pack opening that we did. And by the way, you can look at the pack opening if you didn't see the link on our Twitter feed yesterday at Wax and Gum Stains. You can look for it on YouTube. Just type in Wax Ecstatic Off the Beaten Path Packs. That's the official word I'm going to go with, or the official phrase, because offbeat or oddball is not really appropriate for these. So I say off the beaten path because these weren't your typical Topps, Fleer, and Donruss cards. And the third set we're going to look at is from the Swell collection. And this was kind of a combination of Topps cards. I won't say Topps big because these were standard size cards, but it was kind of a combination of your average Topps baseball card and the Conlon collection, although not featuring greats from the 1930s, but actually a rather eclectic mix of greats, semi-stars, and just interesting people that you probably wouldn't have put in any other scenario. Case in point, Lenny Randle is in one of the packs. You know, you've got Hank Aaron, Ernie Banks, Lenny Randle. You know, it's just one of these three is not like the other. So, you know, for every great player or really incredibly darn good player that you would get in the Swell packs, you got the one where you're kind of going, oh, Eric Soderholm, that's interesting. But there's a big reason why Swell went with some of the more average names of the 60s and 70s, and we'll get into it. And I should mention that all three of these particular sets that we're looking at, not only to get off the beaten path, you know, we've done quite a bit on all the major sets that have been released ever since the late 1940s. But every now and then you've got to kind of veer off course a little bit, because these three particular sets certainly are not bad. And in many ways they're good. And like I said, I think when you circle back around onto Topps Big, if you don't already have an appreciation for it, I think you will now. And these sets are not only just fun to kind of look at before we get back on the main road, if you will, and talk about some of the more commonly known and loved sets at the time, but all three of these sets were suggested by listeners in one form or fashion. I had a couple listeners suggest that we take a look at the big cards. And I said, absolutely. And I had some listener donations, about 20 cards donated a while back. So we looked at those in the video. Same with the Conlon collection, a pack of 1991 and 92 Conlon collection cards. Those were the first 2 years of a 5-year release period for Conlon collection. And these are the most easily accessible cards of the Conlon collection, the 93, 94, 95 sets. You know, as the hobby got more exclusive, as the sets got more exclusive, and the production of sets got to be a little more pricey, then the retail sales point for a lot of those sets also went up. And also the Swell cards, we had a listener just ask us, I believe on our Twitter timeline, or it might have been an email to me, hey, can you talk about some of the Swell baseball greats cards? I said, sure, let me track down some of those cards. And sure enough, I found somebody on eBay selling packs of these Swell baseball cards, a series that ran from 1989 to 91. I got from 1990 four packs of these cards for, I think with shipping, it was only like $8 or $9. It was not that much. So thanks to either listener suggestions or donations, we're able to make this broadcast possible. And when I say donations, that's both ways, donating actual cards, as in the case of the big cards and the Conlon collection packs, or through cash donations, the money that we've received from listener support helped us search these packs down and buy them and share them with you here on the program. So that leads me very quickly to the soft sell of donations. I've received some emails about card donations, and you can email me, by the way, at mattsammonsays@gmail.com. That's mattsammonsays@gmail.com. And I do like to, you know, just make sure that, first of all, you're not just sending me your entire collection, but also that you're sending me stuff that is of value, not necessarily to a personal collection, but to the show. So don't just pack up all of your, you know, 89 tops dupes and send them to me. I've already completed that set. I don't need to do any more. But, you know, you can reach out to me. And if you would like to make a card donation, whether it's a lot of cards or several specific cards, or if it's packs or whatever, if it's something that we haven't discussed on the program, or perhaps it's something we've talked about before, but you don't think we've given it its just due, then certainly a card donation will help us accomplish that. We can talk a little more in depth about those particular cards. But also cash donations. Again, a lot of people under stress here during the coronavirus and all the other incredible stuff going on nowadays. Oh, boy, it was hard to find toilet paper once upon a time. Now we all need riot gear. What the hell's going on here? Well, anyways, as we shield our eyes from the tear gas, we do say that if you do have a few bucks handy, you're more than welcome to make a cash donation to the program at paypal.me/waxecstatic. And again, waxecstatic, all one word, paypal.me/waxecstatic. And it is a soft sell. If you are experiencing any kind of financial hardship, I do not want your money. Keep it in your pocket. Keep it in your bank account, okay? I know you may feel guilty, like, oh, I want to support the show. Just listen, okay? If you want to support the show without spending any money, all you have to do is listen, tell your friends about it, share the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter timeline and the handle to your collecting friends, and also rate and review the show, especially with Apple Podcasts, but really any platform that allows you to rate and review the show. Do that. That helps us get the word out, and that is worth just as much as a $5 donation in some cases. So, you know, that's one way you can help if you don't have the money. But if you do have $5 or $10 and you just feel charitable, you can make that donation. And a reminder that all donations to this program, even the cardboard donations, go to the program. You know, it's all stuff that we talk about here. Cash donations help support us, keeping the show alive on Audio Boom, which sends out the RSS feed to all of the various platforms, such as Apple Podcasts and all the others. And also, we can purchase some of these products that you guys want to talk about, whether it's a swell baseball card lot, or if it's, you know, some packs from the early 90s, or as we've done, you know, we bought some packs from the 70s and opened them up, which is pretty fun to do. So every donation helps. And again, if you can't make it because you're kind of strapped for funds right now, maybe you're part of the 25% of the nation that's out of work right now, keep the money in your pocket. And I reassure you, the money that comes in through donations does not go into my pocket. It does go back to the show, not only for the performance of Audio Boom and also the purchase of products, but again, through kind of a secondhand way. Any cards that we're not keeping here in our collection, we pack up and we send off to Commons for Kids, as they will take those cards. And you can make donations to Commons for Kids as well. Follow them on Twitter, Commons for Kids, and that's the number 4, all one word there, Commons for Kids. You can find the mailing address. We just sent out about 3,000 cards recently. Going to send out a couple more thousand here within the next few weeks, and they will take any cards. Don't just send them your junk wax. Send them some new stuff as well. But whether it's baseball or football, hockey, basketball, even non-sports, Commons for Kids will take those cards, and they will sort them, and they will hand them out to kids in need, not just kids who can't afford sports cards, but also kids who are currently in hospitals, maybe cancer care centers, kids who are just dealing with a very difficult life. And with coronavirus and everything else going on, kids who were already in a tough spot are in an even tougher spot, unfortunately. One way that we can provide a little lightness in a world of darkness is through the fun of baseball cards. And if you can put a handful of cards into a kid's hands and they get to see some of their favorite players, some of their favorite teams, or even players from their favorite teams from many years ago, it is definitely a nice, fun distraction from all the nonsense going on in this world. So just know that whatever you donate. It certainly goes through the proper channels here, and we make sure that many of the things that we handle go into Commons for Kids. And again, you can make your own donations at Commons for Kids. And just follow them on Twitter, get that mailing address, and all those cards you organize. Yes, even the ones in the miscellaneous box. You can go ahead and make a donation there. It is well worth the effort. Now, the upcoming shows, I'll tease you on a few upcoming shows here, as we've done. Next show, which will be on Friday, June the 19th, we're going to take a look at the 94 Tops set. Now, I've got several packs, I believe, from Series 1 of 94 Tops. And I've been waiting to talk about this particular set and these particular packs, because 1994, as I've mentioned, a pivotal year, not just for me in collecting. Basically, I pretty much stopped buying anything that was new. I did buy some vintage stuff. I bought a few packs of 1994 cards, if not baseball, certainly hockey. I remember buying like Fleer Ultra and Parkhurst cards back then. But due to other distractions in my teenage life, I decided to stop spending money on cards and spending it on other stuff. And of course, with the 1994 baseball strike, boy, doesn't this sound familiar? We're kind of heading down that path again, aren't we? Despite the 1994 playoff strike, or the baseball strike, I should say. Yeah, there was a playoff strike, as in there were no playoffs. But, you know, it was a pivotal year for me, and it took me a long time to not only come back to baseball, but also to come back to baseball cards. And I know a lot of collectors are in that same boat. So I want to discuss that a little bit, and that will be done in our next show, 94 Tops. I have not bought a pack of 94 Tops since 1994, and I only bought a couple back then. So it's going to be kind of neat to kind of, peel that scab a little bit. Also, some of you are on to this, the special set of cards that we will be talking about, and we will do this on the following show. And it's appropriate because the following show comes two Fridays after June 19th. And do you know what day that would be? Yes, that would be on the July 4th weekend. If we have not burned our country down to the ground then, or by then, there's still time, we will be celebrating Independence Weekend with a look at Topps UK Minis. Yes, some of you were on to me. You heard my hints, and I either got tweets or direct messages or emails about it. If you sniffed out the hints and went, hey, he's talking about Topps UK Minis, then you're going to enjoy that show. And as I said in the previous show, this was a set that I knew about, didn't collect, obviously, because I was not living in Europe in 1988, but it's a very, very unique set for a number of reasons. Because, first of all, it shows the attempt by Topps to broaden the baseball card collecting world into Europe in the late 1980s. Thinking about the political climate. Now, granted, we're talking, you know, the United Kingdom, so it's not exactly West Germany, but considering the plate tectonics of politics in Europe in the late 1980s, it was a very bold move by Topps. And, sports leagues were, experimenting with, expanding or playing games over in Europe as well during this time. It was also an instructional effort by Topps to explain American baseball to the British, which is ironic, considering baseball in many ways can trace its roots back to cricket, which the Brits are kind of good at. So you've got that. And I also have a bone to pick with the name UK Minis. And I will explain why in that show. It has to do with another country and another independence run. It doesn't really have anything to do with baseball cards, but I would like to set the record straight on something about where those cards were manufactured and the name that we stick to those cards. So if you are a fan of some truly unique cards, you're going to love that show on the 4th of July weekend, as we will be looking at the Topps UK Minis set Yes, you can get the entire set in one teeny tiny box. When I got it in the mail and I was showing it off to my wife and to my kids, we were all making noises like we found a stray kitten. Oh, look at it. It's so small. It's a stack of baseball cards, but we're like, those are so tiny. So you're going to enjoy that because there's a lot to unpack in that set of 88 Tops minis. And really looking forward to doing that as well. And I'll also drop another tease. This will not necessarily be 2 weeks after that show, but I'm just thinking out loud here, and I want to see if there's anybody else who can sniff out these clues. At some point in time, maybe a little later in the summer, I'm going to do a show about a particular set of cards that is extremely well known, that everyone at some point in their collecting life, they've seen it. And there's still plenty of these sets around. But generally speaking, nobody wants them. No, it's not 90 Donruss or 91 Fleer, although thanks to Coach Mike sending me the 90 Donruss Rack Pack with the Ken Griffey Jr. on the top. I may dive into 90 Donruss one day, just when I don't care anymore and I'm in a masochistic state. But no, it's not that. There was a set of cards that was put together for all the right reasons, but nobody wants it. And part of the reason is because despite the age of this set, and I don't want to give it away by saying how old it is, it's up there though. Despite the age of this set and the uniqueness of this set, there were probably about 40 billion of them printed up. And I may be exaggerating, plus or minus a billion, but there's still a lot out there. But I will bring up the merits and the demerits, if you will, of this particular set. And I'll finish up with this. Boy, I'm really teasing you guys on this. And this is a show I'm not even doing anytime soon. We're just kind of thinking out loud. This may be late in the summer. But this is a set that even though there's a whole lot of it and nobody really wants it these days, I'm willing to bet if you're around my age range, so let's just say you're somewhere in your 40s, chances are this set, or at least parts of this set, were in your collection, and you may have learned a thing or two about baseball cards and great baseball players from this set. Boy, I'm leaving a lot of vague hints out there, right? Tune in. That is something, again, I don't want to do it after the Topps Minis show because I want to try to avoid back-to-back oddball sets. But this is a set that I found while digging around my own personal collection a few weeks ago. I still have it. It wasn't even originally mine. It was my older brother's. I think I have all the cards. I need to double check. But it's definitely a unique set. And I know it's passed through your hands at some point in time, whether you wanted it to or not. And we still kind of look down on it. But again, there are some good things about this particular set. We'll dive into that several weeks from now. But I wanted to share that now, because it was fresh. I did find it in that collection recently, and I thought, you know, I actually may dedicate a show to this downtrodden set of baseball cards. I've called 88 Donruss the poster child of junk wax. This set may actually take the crown. It just might. This, nobody likes this set of cards, but there are some good things to it. Let's quickly take a look at some commentary here on our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter timeline from Zach Byrne. Great pod, Wax and Gum Stains. I'm assuming you are going to talk about Topps UK minis. I have those and they make me happy. Yes, you're on it, Zach. We've got it there. So Definitely looking forward to having that conversation. Our good buddy Nick Deonte checking in on our commentary on 91 Bowman, and actually all those early 90 Bowman's cards, has sent out a picture promoting the podcast and mentioning how Bowman's backs were very unique, whether you liked it or not. And Nick commented, those were definitely a cool quality at a time when something like Baseball Reference was a decade away. Absolutely right, Nick. And that's something that I've said before. You know, even before Sabermetrics were Sabermetrics. And I know those advanced stats, those things were popping up in the 70s and 80s. But before Sabermetrics and advanced stats became a household name, and before you could easily look up the splits of a player on a card, you had to have something unique like the Bowman backs in 89 through the mid-90s, where they did the splits and broke things down team by team. Matt Prigge here, an interesting line here. He is in Milwaukee, and he says, can't wait. He was listening to this podcast. We posted the picture of Brian Taylor. He says, Brian Taylor is one of my PCs. Do you mean pitching coaches? I hope so. I hope he's doing something constructive, given some of the destructive things he was doing in his life that we discussed there. So, Matt, if you can chime back in on that, we'd appreciate that. Robert Lawson with a show suggestion, and I may take you up on this one. I'd enjoy a show about the 1987 Donruss opening day set. The 87 base set is up there with 84 for me. It's the best Donruss design ever. And the opening day maroon border is a great choice, possibly an upgrade over the black. I can't decide. Many rookies and stars. Yeah, the 87 opening day set is a very unique set. And even though, as you pointed out, Robert, that the base set certainly stood out, there's a unique color combination with 87 opening day. So I will put that on the list of shows to ponder. Will we do that? Find out later. We'll let you know. And speaking of assorted colors, as we were joking around about the clothes that some of the players wore on the 1992 Bowman casual shots, the Snorting Bull sends us a picture of Braulio Castillo. It says, Braulio Castillo was not a prospect. He was the Phillies' fourth outfielder and a fan of glamour shots. And if you take a look at the Castillo Bowman card from 1992 that the Snorting Bull posted on our timeline, you can see that the only thing missing from this glamour shot is the glittery background. Remember that when you had to get your high school pictures done and they sent you to the studio, whether it was glamour shots or an independent studio. My high school sent us to an independent studio. And the guy who's taking the pictures, you know, he's changing the background. You got this glittery gold thing and then, you know, your standard blue background. And, you know, they give you the cap and gown and then, you know, they try to get you to buy the other pictures in the photo set. So they dress you up, you know, they like put the biker jacket on you. And I am just like so not biker jacket dude. And he's just like, oh, you've got to try this, put this on. And I'm just like, you know, I'm 17. I'm hating, actually I was 16 at the time. I'm 16 going on 17. I'm hating having to follow instructions from anybody. Nevertheless, this guy in the attic of his independent studio dressing me up, you know, like a fashion model in the stinking jacket. And, you know, it's just one of those things where I'm just like, all right, bite the bullet. Let's just get it done with. I'm not buying these. Thankfully, mom and dad never bought those. So you're absolutely right, Snorting Bull. Oh, one other suggestion here from Robert Lawson. As a haunted game was sharing a shot of several pages of 2006 Fleer Tradition. 2006 Fleer Tradition featured one of the best designs of the aughts, the early 2000s, of course, we're talking about there. And, you know, I bring this up simply because, again, as we're, you know, looking for show topics and ideas, there is a possibility I may break down, if I can find it for the right price, and that's the tough part, you know, as cards were, even though the hobby was collapsing in on itself in the mid to late 90s, the cards that were put out, they actually were put out in smaller numbers, and you had your refraction cards and your, you know, certain special inserts and swaths of Babe Ruth's underwear, you know, collectible cards, you know, stuff like that. While that was going on, that drove up the prices and the value of cards. And of course, you know, as we discussed in a recent show about Derek Jeter rookie cards, when you had the next class of young stars, so Jeter and Pedro Martinez and, you know, you name it, you know, Manny Ramirez, you know, anybody who was a star coming up in the mid-90s put a premium on some of those cards. It's a little harder to find good deals on some of the mid to late 90s and early 2000s sets, but we may be exploring some of those sets there. I think we've got to get past 1994 first, and we'll do that in our next show. Well, like I said, we'll pick at that scab, and I think once we close the door on the pain and suffering of being a baseball fan in 1994, it only took 26 years to straighten it out. We'll possibly look into looking at some of the sets again from like 95, 98, and just kind of play around there just a little bit. Now let's play around with some of these off the beaten path sets that we were talking about. And we're going to start with Topps Big, because this is the one I want to spend a lot of time on, looking back at what Topps was trying to do and how they had not only a great concept, but they really had a great marketing plan, a good growth strategy, but it all went awry after year number two. Kind of like the Korean War, you know, you started changing the plans and everything goes crazy here. That's what one of my college professors said. And you know, you read the book, you find out, you know, once you change the strategy, it completely blows up in your face. And that's what happened with Topps. They had a really good thing in 1988, a pretty good thing in 1989. And then trying to keep up with the Joneses in the ever-growing and bloviating world of baseball cards in 1990, they just totally screwed it up. And collectors spoke out loudly by not spending a dime on 1990 Topps baseball, or big baseball, and they killed the line at the end of the 1990 season. So let's take a look back at what Topps was trying to do in 1988. And there is, if you want a full narrative of Topps Big Baseball, I highly suggest you check out at sportscollectorsdigest.com an article written by Bert Lehman back in October of 2018, 30th anniversary, if you will, of Topps Big. And Bert does a really great look back at not just the 1988 set, but all three sets and what went right and what went wrong. But let's take a look at 1988. So going into 1988, Topps knows that they're going to be getting some real competition. Not Sports Flicks. You know, Sports Flicks was kind of dying out by then. And by the way, I need to set the record straight here and correct myself. I've often said that Score was the first set to have full-color headshots of players on the backs of their cards. And I stand corrected. It actually was Sports Flicks. And this is one of those things I've discovered while, you know, mining through the miscellaneous box. In 1987, they actually had little, you know, small kind of like 84 Fleer size headshots on the backs of cards, and they were full color. So I've often given Score the credit because I've defended 88 Score, because a lot of people think that it was 89 Upper Deck that changed the world, and certainly 89 Upper Deck did. But with all the glowing love that's been thrown towards 89 Upper Deck, people forget about the contributions that 88 Score made. So I need to throw in the contribution that 87 Sports Flicks did. Now, of course, by 1987, Sports Flicks is dying on the vine. The technology to make those action cards, if you will, that actually moved as the pictures moved as you kind of flipped the card back and forth and up and down, it was too expensive. It was kind of gimmicky. Fans didn't really buy into it. Plus, you know, certainly by 1987, as we've discussed, Topps, Fleer, and Donruss all producing just outstanding sets back then. So, you know, Sports Flicks was seen kind of as this tchotchke kind of set here. So let's get back to Topps here. They're planning ahead for 1988. Sports Flicks is dying, but they know that Score is around the corner. And they know that they need to put out a product line in this growing world of baseball cards that will stand out from the rest, because other sets are starting to do it. As we mentioned, opening day, Donruss was doing that. And Donruss had been putting out some unique cards before, like the, you know, the Donruss big cards of their own, which were postcard size cards. That was a little inconvenient to try to store those things. But you had those 3x5 size cards back in the mid-80s that they were putting out there. And of course, you know, Fleer had a nice update set, some high-quality sets. Topps already had the Tiffany sets going out there, you know, the glossy versions of the base set. So they needed something else that would stand out from the competition that SCORE was going to send out. And of course, as time would tell, you know, what Upper Deck would bring and ultimately the premium cards. Basically, baseball cards are growing here in 1988. So Topps is not only trying to grow the game internationally with the UK minis, as we were discussing, but they wanted something on the home front that could attract a slightly different customer. So we're mainly looking at younger customers here. How do you get kids into the collecting game so that they not only buy this new set, but they start looking at all the other products that you're putting out there? And in an attempt to market something that is new and different from what was out there at the time, Topps also, I don't think this is an accident, Topps also borrowed a lot of design elements from one of their classic sets, the 1956 set. And the 88 Topps Big Set was a rather unique and very special and classy nod to that 56 set. Now, that's something I never really put two and two together with until several months ago. When I was collecting, and I had started collecting in 1989, although 88 Topps Big Packs were still floating around in the market, I bought a few packs of Topps Big, and I wasn't overly impressed with them. Now, granted, at the time, I would have been, what, 12 years old? So, you know, I'm a little above the age demo. They're probably going for more 7-8-year-old kids, you know, trying to introduce them to the hobby. So I'm a little above the target audience here. And, yeah, they were nice. But, you know, I was just somebody who stuck to, you know, the main products, the base sets of Topps and Fleer and Donruss and eventually SCORE and Upper Deck and Bowman. That's just what I did. So in 1988-89, Topps Big just really didn't speak to me. It just didn't. It just didn't attract me, and that's fine. So I tell you that story because basically 30 years ago, I just put the big set in the back of my mind. I had a few big cards, not many. I remember the Nolan Ryan one, which was one of the donations that we had. And you know, I remember that particular card, but you know, there's just nothing that really stood out from it. I just totally forgot about it. And now that you see so many Topps big cards and packs, you know, kind of in the $3 for $1 bin at your local card store, that adds to it as well. A lot of people look back at those and go, well, that was kind of a failed experiment. And in some ways, yeah, it didn't work. But what I think is worthy of pointing out here is Topps tried to create a new product by modernizing a classic old one, and by golly, they almost pulled it off in 1988. And you don't really recognize or notice the similarities and differences of Topps Big to 1956 Topps until you hold a card of each side by side. And that's something I did in the video. I picked up a Barry Larkin card and I pulled from random one of my 56 Topps cards. It just happened to be Eddie Matthews. And you put them side by side. And while the front of the Topps Big card is clearly a 1988 design, and what I mean by that is where the player's name is at the bottom of the card, I called it kind of a Save by the Bell paint swatch. it's a very late 80s design, you know, kind of the Debbie Gibson, you know, flare of color that's just kind of thrown on the top of a baseball card here. And, you know, other than that, you still have the basic idea of the 1956 Topps card. And that is, you've got the player's headshot in the foreground, and in the background, you have an action shot. Now, in 1988, color film is common. It's easy to get that stuff, and it's easy to just, you know, basically overlay one color photo with another. And in 1956, Topps was still using typically paintings of the headshots with a colorized black and white photo for the background picture. So you've got that difference, but still the general idea is the same. Yes, a 1988 flair to the player's name is written, but the headshot in the foreground, the action shot in the background, all full color. And also, as the name would imply, big. Topps was using the size of the 1956 baseball card for the 1988 set, which is something that, as we'll get into, was part of the downfall of Topps Big. And we're talking 2 5/8 inches by 3 3/4 inches. The standard baseball card since 1957 has been 2.5 inches by 3.5 inches. So that difference of 1/8 inch on one side and a difference of 1/4 inch on another really makes a big difference, as we'll see. Now, speaking of similarities, and this was for me when I was kind of looking around at big cards a while back, this is the big comparable to 56 Topps. If you flip the card on its back, if you look at the back of a 56 Topps card and the back of an 88 Topps big card, in many ways, they are essentially the same, even down to the card number, which is nestled inside a baseball and has a Topps logo. You basically have, obviously, the 1956 version in the old card and a modernized version of it for 1988 in the new card. Player personal information in the same spot, a comic panel of three little stories telling about the player in the middle, and even down to the statistics. Remember, since 1971, Topps had been showing full career statistics, year-by-year statistics, even minor league statistics, on the backs of their cards. Well, that wasn't the case in 1956. They just did the previous year and lifetime statistics. And they would do batting or pitching stats, depending on the position of the player, and a little separate line for fielding stats. And Topps did that to perfection, again, in 1988. And as a fan of vintage cards, and especially the 56 set, which some collectors will argue is the greatest Topps set, when you look at that and what Topps produced with the big set in 1988, you really get an appreciation for, holy cow, they pulled this off. This is an impressive feat of art. This is incredible what Topps has done. And all of a sudden you forget about the size of the cards. You forget about how it's kind of geared towards younger people and it doesn't quite look the same as the base sets. And you look at it and you go, wow, they really pulled this off. And it's actually quite impressive. And when looking at this, I can summarize that this was, in terms of a regularly produced set, not turn back the clock, insert cards, not other cards throughout the years that were just little subsets that may have looked at older cards or were designed like older cards. But this was the first time in my recollection that Topps attempted basically a heritage set. Now, not to what the heritage sets are today, which is basically a mirror image of what was produced 49 years ago, but a modern day twist to a classic set. And while Topps often kind of aped itself on some past sets, you know, the 87 set looked a lot like 62, the 83 set looked a lot like 63. You know, you could always kind of compare and contrast some older sets to newer sets, but they've never really like gone out of their way to try to provide a modernized version of a classic. And that is something that they would eventually do with the Heritage set starting in 2001, where they basically took the exact same design elements and just created it with new players. So in terms of, you know, creating kind of an archive set, a modern day version of a classic, Topps hits this one out of the park. It's incredible how much it mirrors 1956. And the marketing strategy was extremely smart by Topps as well. First of all, because of the production quality of these cards, these were using thicker white stock cards. So kind of think of a Fleer baseball card in 1988. Yeah, much better quality card stock than what you got from the base set for a Topps set. And you had the thicker white cardstock, you had the full color, you had the bigger card, you also had cellophane wrapping, no bubble gum. So this is years ahead of what Topps eventually did in 1992 with the base set. But also, again, you know, what you eventually saw with Score and Upper Deck, and I believe Sports Flix was also kind of in a cellophane wrapper as well. So, you know, Topps was toying around with this well before everybody else did it. And of course, I know Topps was playing around with cellophane tamper-resistant packaging even back in 1983, what's called the Michigan packs. So, you know, this was nothing new for them. But they were way ahead of the curve on this. Also, while Topps had been releasing the main set in just one series release every year since 1974, the big set also went with a throwback with how it was released. There were three separate series of 88 cards, a total of 264 cards. Now, part of this is because of production costs, because you're using that better cardstock and the color ink and the, you know, the bigger size cards and the plastic wrapping. You can't have as many cards in a pack. In fact, big cards only had, or big packs only had, seven cards each in 1988 and 1989. But the good thing is to keep production cost down while providing this bigger, brighter card. You kind of weed through all of the flotsam and jetsam in Major League Baseball. When you're used to 792 cards in a base set, there's a lot of common players in that set. When you have 264, well, guess what? You've eliminated over 500 of them. So what that means is you're basically just giving everybody the stars. You're giving everybody the known players or the everyday players. Maybe it's not a star, but it's somebody who has consistently played in the major leagues for 10 or 15 years at that point in time. And every now and then you might get a rookie prospect as well. So the big set got off to a great start in 1988. But the big problem was the big part. Collectors did not like the bigger size card. They didn't like trying to buy bigger size boxes or the 8 card pages as opposed to 9 cards, cards that barely fit into top loaders. Sound familiar? Yeah. Topps would be dealing with that with the Bowman set in 1989. And it was double whammy for Topps because in 1989, they released the big set, and it's got the modern front, it's got the 1956-esque back, but the cards are still big, and with Bowman also out there, collectors aren't really buying into it, and despite the success of the, or because of the success, I should say, of the 88 set, the 89 set is released in three series of 110 cards each, so 330 cards total. So now you're starting to get into the gluttony of the baseball card hobby in the late 80s, where everyone thought more was better, as we all know now. Not necessarily. So Topps was starting to have a little bit of victim of its own success here with the big product line. It was unique, not universally liked, but it was for the most part accepted in 1988. But in 1989, with also a big-sized Bowman card coming out, and the much better Upper Deck set coming out, all of a sudden Topps Big went from kind of unique throwback to kind of kitschy. And when 1990 Topps Big came around, it was an absolute disaster. Now, I joked about the Saved by the Bell look of the graphics of 1988. Well, if you look at the 1990 Topps Big cards, that is the ultimate Saved by the Bell MTV wannabe look Topps was trying to get. And it's just too noisy. There's just too much going on. They tried way too hard with the design. And they also tried to, you know, slim down the design on the back. It was no longer an ode to the 56 set. It was really kind of a cry for younger kids to buy it. And while they also issued a 330 card set in 1990, and actually featured a couple of decent rookies in the third series, including Larry Walker and Sammy Sosa, Topps Big just was not accepted by hobbyists. In fact, orders for the third series of 1990 Topps Big was so low that the third series with the Walker and the Sosa cards is actually kind of rare because orders were low, stores didn't want them, collectors didn't buy them, and Topps certainly didn't want warehouses full of them. So they ended up having to, you know, basically just trim the production and just get out of the business. And what I mean is, you know, Topps big, getting out of the business. Obviously, Topps didn't. But anyways, the Topps big set, it was the right idea and actually the right execution when it started. But it just didn't quite work out because I think Topps Big, which started as something as unique and different and an ode to a past set, it just didn't really, you know, it didn't stay true to what they were trying to do other than the card size, which again was actually the bad thing about it. Collectors didn't like the card size. Had Topps Big, let's say, instead of trying to modernize it to be 1989, 1990, had they actually kind of just moved forward a year in the throwback set. Can you imagine Topps Big cards with a 1957 design or Topps Big cards with a 1958 design? I'd be curious if that would have worked. It may not have. And in fact, if it didn't, then perhaps we wouldn't have the Heritage set now because people would have said, oh, well, Heritage is just like Topps Big. But that wasn't the case. Even though it just kind of fell apart, it was still a very interesting bet. It was an interesting gamble by Topps to take in 1989 or 1988. And I think it worked in 88, kind of started getting away from its true self in 89, and then was just an absolute hot mess in 1990. Now, if you're looking for Topps Big cards, like I said, you can find packs at your local card show or local card dealers, but also online too. You can find packs and boxes pretty cheap. So if you're somebody who just likes to collect stars, Hall of Famers, then definitely you want to look at the big set because you're going to have all of them there. Like I said, you've basically trimmed down the Topps main set over 500 cards. So you're guaranteed to have a collection of well-known players from the big leagues in 1988-89. I don't know if you want to deal with 1990, but it's there if you want it. Now, one word of caution, however, and this is something that also goes along with the other two sets we're going to briefly discuss about. All of these cards, even though they are fun to collect, and especially if you don't mind the different card size and, you know, a nice collection of well-known star players and in some cases Hall of Fame players, definitely do not go overboard. Don't overspend. Don't buy a case of these thinking you're going to become rich because that's not going to be the case. This is really one of those side project things where if you buy a box, you can probably complete the set, certainly in the 1988 year. So if you buy a box each of series 1, 2, and 3, you're going to complete the set and have some left over. But if you just want a neat little colorful honor to one of the best sets in Topps history with nothing but star players in it, then the big set is certainly one that you can look at. It was the right idea and the right execution. It just strayed off course, and then it was the wrong time too. Had Topps Big come out, he said confidently, in say 1981 or something like that. I'm wondering if maybe it would have lasted a little better had they stayed true to the idea behind it, because you didn't get the flood of card sets that you got in the late 80s as if you tried something like that in the early 80s. But we will never know. All right, let's talk about the next set of cards, the Conlon Collection. And like I said, the Conlon Collection came out from 1991 through 1995, and it is something that the Sporting News teamed up with, and why not? Because it featured some of the best photographs of the Charles Martin Conlon Collection. He was the big photographer in Major League Baseball in the early 20th century. So, you know, he took thousands and thousands of pictures here. And of course, black and white photographs, especially for baseball, they always look good. They always do. It's so hard to find a bad black and white photo in baseball. So the Conlon Collection starts out as a 330 card set. In fact, all five sets would be 330 cards. And it was a very sharp looking card, black borders with a black and white photo, very simple design. I would have loved to have seen, even without the borders, just black and white photos would have been nice. But anyways, you've got very basic information about the players on the back. And, you know, these are also relatively cheap the first couple of seasons or first couple of, you know, sets that came out. As I mentioned before, you've got the prices going up with the 93, 94, 95 sets. Part of this was because of some of the inserts. So even though you had the classic baseball players, you had some of the more modern tricks into getting people to buy these sets. So starting in 1991, there were autographed Bob Feller cards in factory sets. So it may cost you a little more if you try to track down a factory set. And of course, Bob Feller was one of the first ball players to charge to sign his autograph at baseball card shows. So if you didn't want to stand in line and drop $40 or whatever the cost was to get Bob Feller's autograph, you could just go out there and buy the set. But I always liked the Conlon Collection cards, and I also had several of these as a kid, not many. And I remember how striking they were just in their very simple design, the crispness of the photography. And when you add that to a glossy, thick white cardstock, it was really incredible with some of these photographs of some of these players here. And for a youngster such as myself at the time, being a teenager, it was a great introduction to some of the big stars of the game from, you know, the 1920s and the 1930s. You know, you all know about Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and all those other players, but so many players from the early 20th century, and we're talking 1900, 1910, you know, the dead ball era, before baseball players were considered stars and athletic heroes. You know, before Babe Ruth became Babe Ruth and the Roaring Twenties, which was a perfect storm to make him a celebrity in America, you know, baseball players were actually looked down upon. You played professional baseball because you couldn't get a real job. And often, if you were good enough to play professional baseball, it's because you came from a farm town. You know, you came from the sticks. That's why a lot of ball players had the nickname Rube back then, like Rube Walker, Rube Waddell. Well, what's Rube? Well, it's basically, you know, it's a pejorative. It's, you know, basically calling somebody stupid. You know, oh, you know, here's this guy who just fell off the turnip truck. He must be a baseball player. So a lot of people don't know about the history of many ball players from the early 20th century. And again, you know, there's Ty Cobb and Tris Speaker and Walter Johnson, Christy Mathewson. You know, there are players. Shoeless Joe Jackson, of course, comes with a little bit of his own PR baggage, if you will. But despite that, most people don't know about a lot of the ball players that played back then. And I really think the Conlon Collection is a great way to learn a little more about those players. And again, 1991, 1992 sets are a lot easier to come by. Packs are a lot easier to come by as well, relatively affordable. You know, again, the caution that I said with the Topps big set, I wouldn't go overboard in getting these particular cards. But you may want to take a look at them because, like I said, it's a neat little handheld collection of some of the great players that played early in the 20th century. So if you are a history buff and that's your kind of thing, then you definitely want to, if you haven't already, check out the Conlon Collection. A lot of them were released through the Sporting News. And again, they were kind of paired up with the Sporting News back then. And there's still plenty of that product that is out there. And kind of like we talked about with, you know, stats before the internet, unless you went out and got a library book with pictures of these old ball players, this was a great way to open up the door to, oh, this is what baseball was like in 1920 or whatever the case was. So the Conlon Collection is a very unique look into the past and some of the greats of Major League Baseball. Last but not least, we've got the Swell Baseball Greats. Now, these were sets that were produced in 1989, 1990, and 1991, and it featured retired players. So even though it was called Baseball Greats, like I was saying before, you know, you would have Ernie Banks and Hank Aaron, and then here's Lenny Randle. Eric Soderholm was another one that we found in our packs. And, you know, hey, nothing against those guys, but I normally don't put Soderholm or Randle quite in the same category as an Aaron or a Banks. So It was an interesting collection in each set, 135 card sets featuring these retired players. Now, these were produced by the Swell Baseball or Swell Chewing Gum Company, I should say, the Philadelphia Chewing Gum Company, which made Swell brand chewing gum. There we go. And this wasn't their first foray into sports products. They had actually made football cards back in the 1960s, I believe in the 1970s. And basically, this was just an attempt to cash in on nostalgia. And I've talked about now we're living in an era of 90s nostalgia, and I'm sure within the next 2 to 3 years, the nostalgia will move up a few years and people will pine for the days of the early 2000s for whatever reason. But certainly in the early 1990s, the nostalgia, if you swing it back about 20 years, you know, this is Wonder Years era. So a lot of these ball players were players who played in the late 1960s and early 1970s. So not quite Conlon collection variety of players here, but still just, you know, making a grab for the attention of fans who wanted to kind of, you know, remember some of the greats from their childhood, not necessarily greats from early in the century. Now, a little background about this particular set. It was produced by CMC Licensing. That is a company that is best known for owning the intellectual property of dead celebrities. So quite the financial backing here for the Swell baseball greats. And like I said, Philadelphia Chewing Gum Company actually distributed this, and that's where they got the Swell brand, basically. Now, it is fully licensed by Major League Baseball properties, but because there were no current players, it was not licensed by the Players Association. So you may buy a pack of these cards back then and open it up and get a Hank Aaron, but Hank Aaron didn't see a penny from these cards because, you know, he wasn't a current player then, and the Players Association didn't necessarily sign off on this. Now, if you are looking for a unique collection of these players, this is definitely a good set to do it. Now, I've got the 1990 cards. Like I said, they released cards in the previous year and the following year. Slightly different designs, but very, I don't want to say cartoonish, but it did have kind of just a low rate look to it. It was not very creative. So I think that's one reason why I don't recall buying any Swell baseball cards from back then. And again, we were flooded by all the other base sets at the time, and certainly by 1991, you're getting flooded by the premium sets that were coming out. So if you were, like me, a buyer of just the mainline products, then the Swell baseball greats never really passed in front of you, and you didn't notice, and chances are you didn't care. But for a pretty affordable price these days, you can still buy these online, either in separate packs or even boxes in some cases. And if you're somebody who just likes to look at color photography of some of the game's greats from the 1960s and 70s without having to spend the extra money to get a 69 tops Tom Seaver or a 71 tops Hank Aaron, or that 73 tops Lenny Randle you've been looking for, the 78 tops Eric Soderholm, you can certainly get a good, concise checklist of the stars, the regular players of back in the day, in these Swell baseball sets. Now, there is another benefit to the Swell sets. These are a favorite of autograph collectors, and especially since many, not all, but many of these players are still alive today. A lot of collectors like to take the Swell baseball great cards and get those autographed because, first of all, you don't necessarily bring down the value of cards from the 1950s and 60s with an autograph. And again, you know, an autographed item, it's up to the market to determine the price, but some people, you know, if you've got a 58 tops Hank Aaron, you may not want Hank Aaron to scribble his name on it. You have him sign a ball or something. But if you've got the 1991 Swell Best card number 2 of Hank Aaron, like we pulled from one of our packs, looks pretty sharp with that white card stock. You get the blue marker, and it looks really good. So I know some fans really like the Swell Baseball Greats collection for those card show autograph sessions because the autographs look sharp on these cards, and you don't have to sacrifice one of your cards from the 50s or 60s to get that autograph. So that is a bonus of that particular set there. And it was kind of fun to open those up, even though we did have, in one of the packs, we had a little bit of a recycling of some of the cards. So we got 6 or 7 dupes, but some pretty good cards in and around that second cycle of cards that was in there. And that's the downside, too. They were still packaging these cards in 36 packs in a box, I believe 10 cards per pack. Well, if you only have 135 cards, one box, you might be able to get 2 complete sets out of pretty easily. So just be aware of that if you're somebody who goes out to purchase a box and you're trying to put together a set. So, you know, that was one of those sets that you bypassed back in the day, and it's completely understandable why you did. But I think at the same time, there's certainly some value in picking up some of these unique cards. And certainly if you're a fan of a player, so let's say you're a Hank Aaron fan and you're collecting all of Hank Aaron's cards, yeah, you're going to put down a pretty penny for that 54 tops Hank Aaron, or, you know, even a 74 tops Hank Aaron. You know, those are not cheap, even if you're getting them in near mint condition or slightly less. But for a swell best card, you're probably, if you're ordering it on eBay, you're probably just spending $1 for it, probably spending more on shipping to get it to you. All right, let's take a look at some of the cards that we pulled here. I decided not to pull any of the players from the Topps big cards simply because, well, they're well-known players. Chances are you've already known about some of the players that were featured in the stack of cards that I had. But I thought maybe some of the cards from the Conlon Collection packs and some of the cards from the Swell Baseball Greats packs would do. So I took one card from the 91 Conlon Collection, one from the 92, and then I grabbed a couple from the Swell cards. And let's start with the 91 Conlon Collection pack, the card that I selected simply because we've got to, you know, get a little Heine every now and then. Yes, Heine Mnuchin. And I'm sure you're wondering, who would name their kid Heine? Well, you'll be happy to know that most sane people don't name their kids Heine. That was not his birth name. It is actually Henry Emmett Mnuchin, a native of Tuscumbia, Alabama, born there in 1901. Now, how did he get the name Heine? I know what you're thinking. It's kind of like that scene in Revenge of the Nerds. Why do they call you Booger? I don't know. Well, no, it actually doesn't have anything to do with his posterior or anything he did or didn't do with it. No, actually, Heine was a rather non-politically correct slur, if you will, nickname, I don't know, of his German heritage. Yes, like a Heineken, all right, a Heine. So when you hear the name Heine Mnuchin, don't think of backside, think of a German beer, because in many ways, that's what he was being referred to here. And of course, with the German immigrants growing up in the Deep South, a lot of people would make fun of German family members. And Mnuchin was one of 8 kids growing up in Alabama, 7 boys, 1 girl, and in fact, 6 of the 7 boys ended up playing professional baseball, which is incredible. Now, at the age of 17, Mnuchin was a student at the Massey Military Academy in beautiful Pulaski, Tennessee. I've driven through Pulaski, Tennessee. Beautiful is about the only word I can think of. Now, like a lot of ball players back in this time, remember what I was saying about how prior to Babe Ruth's arrival, being a baseball player was not a glorious job. You were not a superstar. Even if you were one of the best players in the major leagues, people did not necessarily look up to you. You were often looked down upon. And part of that is because a lot of these players, you know, they're rural players. They're growing up in faraway places like Tuscumbia, Alabama, which is up in the Muscle Shoals area in the northwestern part of the state, or, you know, playing or going to school in, you know, rural areas in Tennessee like Pulaski. So, you know, a lot of people thought that baseball players were just dumb players. And you had these players basically barnstorming for work and playing baseball kind of on the side, you know, often playing for pickup teams, company teams, you know, for whatever factory they worked for or whatever town they lived in. And that was certainly the case with Mnuchin, as he was working for one of his brother's plumbing companies in Burlington, Iowa, after his college days, got into professional baseball in 1921, so he's 20 years old at this time. And he would eventually wind his way around through the Western Canadian League, eventually the Western League in Omaha, and then he would sign a contract with the Detroit Tigers. Now, he would make his major league debut in 1923, was part of a star-studded outfield for the Tigers, along with Harry Heilman and, of course, the legendary Ty Cobb. And, of course, the Tigers were a pretty dominant time, or a dominant team, I should say, at this time in the mid-1920s. Now, he had a very good rookie season. In fact, he had a .334 batting average. His second season, not so good, even though his numbers were decent by today's standards, you know, a .289 in 1924, a .302 in 1925. Still, you're looking 30, 40, even 50 points away from what he was able to put up there in his rookie season in 1923. Now, he was platooned a lot in the early days in Detroit and finally got an opportunity to shine in 1927 when Cobb would go to Philadelphia to play for the Athletics, and Manouche thought he would get an opportunity to really stand out in the Tiger outfield with the old veteran moving to Philadelphia. Well, that was not the case, as Cobb was replaced in the Detroit dugout by George Moriarty, a longtime Tiger player from earlier on in the century, and Manouche wasn't a favorite of Moriarty, and on top of that, with Cobb out of the lineup, Manouche wasn't able to take advantage of having Cobb batting in front of him. So he went from hitting in the mid-300s in 1926 down to .298. Again, .298 is normally not that bad, but when you're, you know, constantly hitting in the 300s, the mid-300s at that, all of a sudden people are wondering what's going on with you. Like I said, he had some clashes with his manager, so after the 1927 season, the Tigers trade Manouche, along with first baseman and one of the great 1920s baseball names, Lou Blue, to St. Lou, the Browns, in fact, in exchange for Harry Rice, Ellum Van Gilder, and Chick Galloway. Now, with the St. Louis Browns, Manouche was able to revitalize his career a little bit, also get away from the shadows of, you know, Briggs Stadium and you know, playing under Ty Cobb for so many years. And he was able to flourish as a hitter. In fact, in 1928, finished the season with a .378 batting average. He was in a back-and-forth battle with the legendary Goose Goslin for the batting title. And while he flourished in St. Louis for many years, he would eventually get traded to the Washington Senators, ironically, in exchange for Goslin. And during the years, the late 20s, Goslin with Washington, Manouche with St. Louis, would have these playful little side bets who would out-hit the other. And, you know, they had this kind of friendly rivalry. I don't know actually if friendly is the right word. It was heated at some times, but there was a rivalry here, and ironically, they were traded for one another in the middle of the 1930 season. Now, this was also a boost for Manouche. While he was doing well individually in St. Louis, the Browns were not doing so well. In fact, they would start basically an almost 15-20 year run of just terrible baseball. But he was able to give a boost to the Senators, as he was able to finish up the 1930 season with Washington hitting .362 in 88 games. Now, he would hit a more modest .307 in 1931, but as the to and fro batting average record of Heinie Manouche played out again, he would succeed in 1932 with a .342 batting average. He was a big part of the they were nicknamed the Nats, but the Senators, 1933 American League Championship season, and an epic battle with the New York Giants and Carl Hubbell, one of the other cards that we pulled from the pack there. And he also has a rather unique moment in baseball history, as Manouche was struggling a lot in the series and was actually tossed out of a game by one of the umpires during, which game was it? I believe it was game 3 of the series. So Manouche, who had a temper, decided to, go after the umpire who threw him out. He had to be physically restrained by his manager and also other umpires. And this game was happening in Washington, so the fans were throwing soda bottles at the umpire's direction. And it was a little bit of a free-for-all going on at this point in time. And I say that he's part of an interesting point in baseball history because at the time, the baseball commissioner, Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who was at the game, didn't agree with the umpire's decision to toss Mnuchin. So he ruled from then on that no player in the World Series could be ejected without first getting the commissioner's permission. Of course, those rules have changed since then, but it's very rare that an umpire will tee up a player or a coach in the World Series. But Landis had to kind of throw down the gauntlet then, first of all, to kind of quell the ugly scene at Griffith Stadium, but also to kind of set the tone with the umpiring crew. Hey, it's the biggest game or the biggest series of the season. You can't just throw players out here for whatever reason. Now, in 1934, Mnuchin would be an All-Star. It was only the second year of the All-Star game, but the only time that he would be an All-Star. And that would also kind of be the swan song for his career. Started bouncing around throughout the major leagues in the late 1930s, first with the Red Sox, later with the Dodgers, and then after a stint playing minor league baseball with Toronto, in Pittsburgh with the Pirates, and the Pirates were essentially a minor league team in the late 1930s. Now, he would not stop playing, though. He became a player manager back in the minor leagues, again with the Toronto Maple Leafs, and then eventually ending his playing days, but continuing to manage throughout the minor leagues in the 1940s. He would get into scouting with the Washington Senators, first in the early 1950s, and then with the second version of the Senators in the early 1960s. In 1963, the Veterans Committee voted him into the Hall of Fame, and he would tragically pass away in 1971 after a long fight with cancer. So there you go, the story of Heini Mnuchin. No, it's not about the posterior here. That was just actually a little bit of a gag of his German heritage growing up in Alabama early in the 20th century. The late Henry Emmett Mnuchin. Now, talk about great names and players with tempers. And you talk about tragic deaths. Ladies and gentlemen, may I give you Hack Wilson. Now, Hack Wilson, even though he had a tragic upbringing, a tough pro career, and a tremendous downfall, he is actually immortalized as part of a combination of former players who became a manager in a major motion picture. And I will tell you about that in just a moment. You may already know the answer to that trivia question. Well, Hack Wilson, better known as Lewis Robert Wilson, born in Elwood City, Pennsylvania, just northwest of Pittsburgh in 1900. And this is a guy who was born in a very bad situation. His mother and father were both degenerate alcoholics. And part of Hack Wilson's physical stature as he grew up, he was 5'6", roughly 210, 220 pounds, depending on, where in his career. His face was shaped oddly. He had a lot of muscles, a very thick neck, but tiny feet. These are all signs of fetal alcohol syndrome. So there's a very good chance that while he was in his mother's womb, his mother was heavily drinking, and this would affect his physical stature later on in life. Now, as if the physical stature wasn't bad enough, his mother passed away of appendicitis when he was only 7 years old. Hack's father was a steel worker. After his mother died, he basically just left his son to be raised by his grandmother in a boarding house. So he was, almost essentially a foster child, just getting passed around from home to home. Now, how does he get the nickname of Hack? Well, one of the reasons is he was working for a locomotive company, and swinging that sledgehammer was able to build up those muscles, and of course was able to take some pretty good hacks at the baseball as well. He was starting to get the attention of people in baseball when his family moved to Martinsburg, West Virginia. That's another splendid little Appalachian town I've been to. Splendid, he said, sarcastically, tongue firmly planted and cheap. No offense to anybody who's living in Martinsburg, but it's an interesting town, I will say that. He was playing with the Sandlot teams mainly as a catcher, and in his first game with the Martinsburg Blue Sox, he broke his leg sliding into home. So he had to basically change his position from catcher to outfield to deal with the physical challenges that he had recovering from that broken leg. And unfortunately, like many children of degenerate alcoholics, alcohol was a constant problem in Hack Wilson's life, as he would abuse it, get into a lot of trouble, had a very blue mouth to speak with. He got into a lot of fights as well. And what really saved him in the long run was his ability to play ball. And he had a very good swing. He had a lot of power. He was, despite his awkward body type, was a very good outfielder, very fast. And he was signed by the New York Giants in 1923, had a nice cup of coffee with the team, and begins in the Giants outfield at the Polo Grounds in 1924. But he really struggles here, has to deal with injuries, has a tough learning curve here as a youngster playing a full season of baseball. And as the 1924 and 1925 seasons go on, he's struggling. Manager John McGraw is not happy with him. He's having some run-ins with Hack Wilson. So finally, at the end of the 1925 season, despite the potential that Wilson has, the Giants decide to basically just put him on waivers, in which the Chicago Cubs pick him up. Now, the Chicago Cubs turned out to be a lifesaver for Hack Wilson, as he became a star with the Cubs in the late 1920s. And of course, think about Chicago in the 1920s. What do we got going on then? We've got mob life. It's all Al Capone. You've got the underground speakeasies and liquor traffic going on here. That's Hack Wilson's kind of town. He can live in Chicago during the roaring 20s. And even though he would say that he never played a game drunk, he did show up at the ballpark hungover more often than once. But again, his talents are able to help lift him up here, and he would have a tremendous 1930 season where he hit 56 home runs, although there are some people who will argue that technically he hit 57, an umpire with a bad call on a ball that should have been called fair. That was actually foul. But Wilson's 56 home runs would stand the test of time. It was a National League record for 68 seasons. That, of course, 1998, when Cub Sammy Sosa, of course, Mark McGwire of the Cardinals, surpassed that number with their home run totals that year. So despite the tremendous 1930 season offensively and being a star and really living the life of, some incredible times in Chicago in the late 1920s, again, his alcoholism came back to bite him in the rear end. All the fights he got into on and off the field. Also blowing game four of the 1929 World Series, Cubs and Athletics. Cubs looking to tie the series up at two games apiece. Wilson not once but twice loses a fly ball in the sun. The A's have a 10-run rally when he does this. So the A's go on to win the game. They win the series in five. And apparently Wilson was never able to kind of pull himself back together after that, at least, in World Series glory. Like I said, he had a great 1930 season at the bat, but that was pretty much it. Now, after that great 1930 season, Wilson would really struggle in 1931, mostly because of change at the helm of the Chicago Cubs. Joe McCarthy, who kind of protected Wilson, went on to manage the Yankees, and Rogers Hornsby comes in. And Hornsby was a no-nonsense disciplinarian And you take a guy like Hack Wilson in Chicago, those two are not going to work real well. And they battled throughout the 1931 season. Lots of fights, lots of incidents, lots of fines going on as well. And after the 1931 season, the Cubs trade him to the St. Louis Cardinals. Now, the Cardinals also decided to cut Wilson's pay, which he did not like, so he didn't sign a contract. Eventually, he gets traded to the Brooklyn Dodgers for a minor leaguer in cash. Remember, the Dodgers in the early 1930s were not a very good team, so this was, in many ways, a demotion. And while he had a decent season with the Dodgers in 1932, again, his career is going down and down and down as he continues to drink more and more and more. He's showing up at training camp at 230 pounds. Remember, he's only 5'6", so now he looks like a walking beer keg. And the Dodgers management, in fact, called Wilson, quote, just a fat and fussy little fellow who hit for a meager 266 last year and covered the outfield like a man with a trunk on his back. Obviously, not a whole lot of people clamoring for Hack Wilson at this point in time. In 1934, he would appear in his last major league game. This would be August of 1934. Played in the minor leagues for a few games in 1935, and then that was it. So this is where the tragedy of Hack Wilson really amps up here. He gets involved in a lot of bad business ventures. And you have to think of a guy whose income was dwindling, had to pay a lot of fines, had to pay a lot of bets off, blew a lot of his money drinking and partying as a ball player, didn't have a lot of money, and whatever money he was in hold of, he was investing it in a lot of bad business properties when in the middle of the Great Depression. So it's just layering on over and over and over and over again. He's having home problems. His wife is divorcing him. And he ends up actually being a drifter. He ends up moving to Baltimore in 1941. First works for an aircraft assembly plant. Quits the defense industry, starts bartending, and he was a bartender for several years, and eventually he starts working for the city of Baltimore. And once several people in the city office realize who he is, they decide to give him a raise as an attendant at a public swimming pool. Just strange, how they thought that was some kind of a promotion, but that's what he had. And then the tragedy comes to a close November 23rd, 1948, when he passes away several days after having a fall at home. Nothing malicious with the fall, according to reports. However, he dealt with some complications in the hospital afterwards and died at just 48 years old. Now, as I said, Hack Wilson did get some accolades after his death. The Veterans Committee voting him into the Hall of Fame in 1979. Also has a lot of parks and streets named after him in his hometown in Pennsylvania. But I mentioned, too, that he has a Hollywood connection. Hack Wilson was one of two ruckus ball players, along with Double X Jimmy Fox, who created the personality for the character Jimmy Dugan, the manager in A League of Their Own, played by Tom Hanks. So while the real Jimmy Fox, yes, he had some battles with the bottle, but he was able to put together a pretty decent life after his playing days. Hack Wilson was at the other end of the spectrum, so you can kind of see how the two combined create the often hungover, misogynistic, at the end of the road, Jimmy Dugan, that is featured in that great movie from 1991. So that is the story of Hack Wilson. Now let's move on to the swell baseball great cards. And this is not just a great player, underrated player too, because he was surrounded by so many stars, but just a great personality and a great gap tooth smile. The man with the big bat, Manny Sanguin. Now, he is best known for his offense in 13 seasons in the major leagues. He swung a 40-ounce bat and had a .296 lifetime average, .398 slugging percentage. But let's not forget about his defensive prowess. He was primarily a catcher in his career, and with his big body, had a big, strong arm. Threw out 39% of runners trying to steal against him during his career. He also had a great chemistry with his pitchers. He caught Bob Moose's no-hitter in 1969, was a big part of Steve Blass's tremendous 1971 season. So a lot of that Pittsburgh Pirates success in the late 60s and early 70s, you can thank Manny Sanguin for that part. Now, of course, you're always thinking of Roberto Clemente. You're thinking of Willie Stargell and Bill Mazeroski at the end of his career. And like I said, Steve Blass, for example, Doc Ellis, of course. But Manny Sanguin was in many ways kind of the glue for that team, for everything that he could do offensively, defensively, and also just kind of as a high-energy locker room guy. A fun story about Manny as he is growing up. One of 13 kids growing up in Panama, that would be seven boys and six girls. There we go, seven and six. And poor Manny was the middle child. We all know what the middle child syndrome is like. You always kind of need that big personality. And he certainly had it. He was starting to get the attention of Major League Scouts in the early 1960s. The Pirates had their eye on him. And they found out that the Houston Colt 45s were interested in signing him. So the Pirates very quickly signed him and got him into their organization. Now, he slowly moves up through the Pirates organization. He had a cup of coffee with the team in 1967, but then manager Danny Murtaugh said that they still wanted the young catcher to get a little more seasoning in the minor leagues, but they did protect him on the 40-man roster. So a couple more years in the minor leagues, Sanguin comes up for good behind the plate in Pittsburgh in 1969, and as I said, was a very big part of the Pirates' success in the 1971 World Series and also the numerous Pirates' appearance in the playoffs throughout the early 1970s. Now, as age started catching up with him and also just his body size started wearing down the joints, the Pirates were starting to figure out if they could put Sanguin in the outfield. And, of course, Sanguin very close with Roberto Clemente, and Sanguin wanted to play in right field more than left field, and Clemente's like, you're not going to take my position. Of course, he's kind of saying this half-jokingly. Well, unfortunately, it wasn't a joke after Clemente's death in the plane crash on December 31st, 1972. Who would be the starting right fielder opening day 1973? Yes, you guessed it. Manny Sanguin, big number 35, roaming around in right field at Three River Stadium back then. Now, because of age and the broken down joints, and of course the emotional toll of trying to play without Clemente in the lineup or even part of the club anymore, Sanguin struggled a little bit, so the Pirates had to kind of shuffle him around a little bit for him to get used to playing the outfield position. And of course, fortunately for the Pirates at the time, they had Dave Parker coming up through the system, and of course he was able to slot himself out in the outfield there starting in the mid-1970s. Now, the Pirates were also locking up catchers. They were able to bring in Duffy Dyer, and there just really wasn't a whole lot of room for Sanguin, who was kind of getting into a backup role. Well, in the 1977 offseason, he would be on his way to Oakland, and it is again because of some tragedy here, as Bob Moose gets killed in a car accident following a birthday party. Danny Murtaugh died in December of 1976. So the Pirates need a new manager. They bring in Chuck Tanner from Oakland, while Charlie Finley, of course, not willing to just give his great manager up, even though Finley was trying to blow up the A's at the time. So he demanded some compensation. Well, that compensation happened to be Manny Sanguin. So his 1 year in Oakland, bats .275, which is kind of for him. He's also splitting catching duties with Jeff Newman. The A's are not a very good team, as Finley is just stripping them apart. And just before the start of the 1978 season, the Pirates would pick up Sanguin once again, much to the chagrin of Ed Ott and Duffy Dyer, the catching tandem, because Sangian, of course, there was no DH in the National League, so he had to play some games there. Now, even though his playing time did decrease in the late 1970s, he was still a key part of the Pirates organization for a couple more years. Won a World Series with them again in 1979 against Baltimore. And he was pretty much a pinch hitter starting in 1980. At the end of the 1980 season, he was traded along with Burt Blyleven to Cleveland, but Sangian never played for the Indians in the regular season as he was released during spring training in 1981, and he would retire soon afterwards. Now, anytime there is a Pirates alumni event, and there's still plenty of them because the Pirates haven't had a whole lot to crow about since 1979, you can bet the man with the big bat, Manny Sangian, is at them. He's a very active member there. He has also hosted a barbecue stand behind center field at PNC Park that bears his name, and he is still a fan favorite all these years later. All right, last but not least, one of my favorite, it's not a palindrome, it's alliteration, I guess would be the right word here. Wearing his Padres uniform, Johnny Podres. And there's more than just name similarities here between Podres and Padres. There's actually a connection that goes back to Podres' day in Brooklyn with the Dodgers. Now, Johnny Podres was born in the Adirondacks of New York, Witherby, New York, not to be confused with Willoughby of Twilight Zone fame, but not too far from Cooperstown. He actually grew up as a Dodgers fan, listening to the Dodgers on the radio, and he was able to get the attention of a lot of scouts while he was in high school, as he was a top southpaw, a great left-handed pitcher, and he was able to, like I say, get a lot of attention of some major league scouts during this time. Now, he would pitch for Burlington in the Summer Collegiate Northern League in 1950 following his high school graduation, eventually moves up the ladder with the Piedmont League's Newport News Dodgers, later the Hazard Kentucky Bombers in the Mountain States League. And listen to this record here. With the Hazard Bombers, 21-3, 228 strikeouts, and an earned run average of 1.67. Not too shabby for the young man. What was shabby was the culture shock of this kid growing up in rural New York, going through the minor leagues in the South in the 1950s. It was a very interesting time for him. But even though he was struggling with the culture shock, he was not struggling on the field. He was often one of the top prospects for the Dodgers, who had some pretty good pitchers at this time, mind you, but certainly as a lefty was drawing the attention of many fans. Now, he would eventually move up to Brooklyn, finally in 1953, even though he didn't have an impressive earned run average that year, 4.23. He went 9-4 in his rookie season, started 18 games, pitched 15 times in relief, was part of the Dodgers National League pennant, and made some appearances in the World Series against the Yankees. And then in 1954, he was able to continue impressing the Dodgers brass with an 11-7 record, 21 starts. And in 1955, it didn't look like Johnny Podres would be going into a spell of success. He had a 9-10 record, was just kind of average to say the least. However, he was called upon in some big games. First of all, Game 3. By Walter Alston, and the Dodgers won that game over the Yankees decidedly 8-3. And it was Podres who was the starting pitcher in Game 7 of the 1955 World Series. Not only did Podres do extremely well, pitching the complete game 2-0 shutout for the Dodgers' only World Series victory in Brooklyn against the rival Yankees, but also that was the game with the legendary Sandy Amoros catch against Yogi Berra. Or with Yogi Berra at bat, I should say, and a long fly ball to left field, and Amoros with a circus catch to save the game and to save the ultimate win there for Podres. Now, after that successful 1955 season, what does Podres do? He serves in the Navy. Yeah, even though he was not grade A military material earlier on in the decade during the Korean conflict, by 1956, the Navy said, yeah, you're good enough for us. So he served in the Navy in 1956, came back to the Dodgers in 1957, followed the team out to Los Angeles and would play with the Dodgers throughout the early 1960s, was part of their world champion teams there. And after the 1965 World Series championship, would start with the Dodgers in 1966. However, would get moved to Detroit early on in that season. Let's see. He was traded on, I'm trying to find the date here, May 9th, 1966. Actually, he wasn't traded. He was waived, and the Tigers bit on him, figured they could use a good, crafty, veteran left-hander. So he would play with the Tigers to the beginning of the 1968 season. The Tigers cut him loose, unfortunately, right before their world championship season in 68. And Padres reached out to his former teammate, Gil Hodges, who is now the manager of the Mets. The Mets didn't want him because he was an older player. The Mets were going young at the time. The Dodgers reportedly offered a pitching coach position with their AAA farm club in Spokane, but apparently Padres turned that down. Well, Padres makes a comeback in 1969 as he plays for the Padres. So what's the connection between Padres, the Padres, and the Dodgers from the 1950s? Well, it would be Buzzy Bavasi. Bavasi was a key part of Padres' development with the Brooklyn Dodgers in the early 1950s. And of course, he was a general manager of the Dodgers throughout the 1960s. Could not get any higher up in the Dodger food chain. Of course, that's no surprise with the O'Malley family running it. Peter O'Malley was being groomed as the next general manager. So as the story goes, Walter O'Malley wanted to try to part on good graces. And when the National League was expanding in 1969, supposedly O'Malley said to Bavasi, well, where do you want to go? And whichever team you want to manage, I will support the vote of expanding to that city. So Bavasi selected San Diego. So while that's not the only reason why the San Diego Padres came into existence, that is a key reason. And of course, it created a great rivalry that's still to this day between the Dodgers and the Padres. And Bavasi was the first general manager of the Padres. And of course, with an expansion team, you've got a collection of, you know, 4A players or a bunch of over-the-hill players. Well, certainly filling the over-the-hill capacity would be Johnny Padres, as he had a 5-6 season. The Padres were not a very good team, obviously, in 1969. However, he was able to wrap up his career in the big leagues and not just kind of flailing around like with Detroit a couple years earlier. Now, he would become a pitching coach with the Padres, later the Red Sox, Twins, and Phillies. In fact, through the mid-1990s, and he was very influential with several pitchers, including Curt Schilling, also Tommy Green, who threw a no-hitter back in the early 1990s. And he was very influential also with Frank Viola with the Twins. Now, after his baseball life, he would return to upstate New York, passing away in 2008 after battling a leg infection as well as heart and kidney disease. So there you go. The Padres of the Padres, with a hat tip to the Dodgers for many, many years. So some interesting stories from some of those classic cards that we found in the Conlin collection and also the Swell Baseball Great collection. And these are some great cards. Again, you can get them relatively inexpensive. You can find them pretty much anywhere now at a good price. But as I cautioned you earlier, I wouldn't spend big bucks on these, even though you do have a pretty good assortment of either then contemporary stars with the Topps big cards of the 1980s and 1990, or some of the greats of the games in the Conlin collection and the Swell baseball great cards of the early 1990s. Well, that'll wrap up our podcast for this week. Really appreciate you joining me. Make sure you come into the baseball card clubhouse here. Help me organize some more miscellaneous boxes. As for the first time in nearly 25 years, we're going to, or actually more than 25 years, yeah, 26 years as my high school math kicks in, as we go back to my senior year in high school, and for the first time since then, we will open up some 1994 Topps baseball packs and pick at the scab of the strike and the, you know, bloating industry that was the baseball card industry in the mid-1990s. We will go ahead and do that in our next show. And that will be 2 weeks from today, Friday, June the 19th. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks again for tuning in to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next time.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.